call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee to order. We have a number of confirmations to the three different boards, and also the confirmation of Thomas Johnson of the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and Speaker Steve Swigum as Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. So certainly we're not going to ask everybody to introduce themselves on these boards, but maybe is there somebody that could kind of very, very briefly tell us what the three boards do and hopefully that they're working well, and I think we'll just take them all. Mr. Swigum, did you wish to talk about the high-pressure piping system board? And
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And members, maybe I'll speak to the three boards that are before you. Can I do them all at once?
Sure,
probably,
absolutely.
As far as general background. In the code consolidation bill that was passed last year by the House, Senate, and signed by the governor, I think carried here by Senator Scheid, is that correct? And thank you for carrying our cleanup bill this year, too, as well. You always got to do a little cleanup in a big bill. But these three boards, these three decision-making boards, were authorized as part of statute. The law that passed designated certain spots, certain provisions, certain members to be placed upon the boards. I, as commissioner, at least at this point, commissioner, at least appointed commissioner at this point, would also have a seat on each of the three boards. The three boards are decision-making boards, Mr. Chairman and members. They have met a significant number of times, each of them. I think the plumbing board has probably met five or six times. Each of the other two boards have met three or four times. They were all appointed, Mr. Chairman, by the governor in September. We went through an extensive process of trying to find the applications, look through the applications, find the right people to bring forward a balance that was represented both by the law that passed as well as a balance that was represented in real life by people who come forward and apply for the boards. We think we have struck that balance, and we've struck some very, very, very good citizens who are willing to commit of their time and serve on these boards. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions that you might have, but certainly would appreciate your confirmation of the members of all three of the boards. I think they represent Minnesota well.
I should note, Speaker Swigum, are these kind of like business types and labor kind of divided, or what's the makeup?
Both, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And by statute, and maybe we could refer to the author of the bill, Senator Scheid.
No, she wants to rest this afternoon.
But by statute, Mr. Chairman, members, there were certain persons of certain categories of either occupation, either business and or labor occupation, and or citizen member that we had to appoint from an occupation standpoint, and then we just tried to find good people. And very honestly, we had lots of good people apply that we had to say no to because, you know, we only had a certain number of spots on the board. So I don't want to say that we didn't that we only selected the good ones. These were good people, but there were good people who applied who we were not able to appoint as well.
Okay, that's what I thought I remembered that.
I think we in the
combination of, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think in the code cleanup bill of this year, one clarification that we needed in Senator Scheid's bill had to do with the public members. To clarify, Senator Scheid, that they actually be public members and not public members with some type of a interest or expertise background.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me also that when we were doing this in the last session that the result of the legislation was a real lot of people cooperating and agreeing to do it. And so I think what we ended up with was a pretty good compromise and a lot of people happy with the results.
Good deal. Speaker Swigum, did you?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one thing. As we tried to choose the persons for the boards into the right categories, we tried very, very hard to find the appropriate balance and the appropriate diversity of geographic. As you notice, we tried to find a significant number of members from around the state, outstate Minnesota, as well as the metro area, which was a little more difficult to find. We tried very, very hard to find gender diversity there. tried to find all the things in the mix that bring the balance to a good board.
Okay, and I think we'll take the confirmation of the three separate motions. A high-pressure piping system is one, and Senator Scheid would move the recommendation that the appointments be confirmed on the high-pressure piping system of all these people that are listed. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. That's a recommendation to the full body that these folks be confirmed. And then on the second one, the plumbing board. Senator Rosen, do you like all these folks on this board? I'm sure you do, yeah. Senator Rosen will move that this committee recommend to the full Senate that the confirmation of the plumbing board be recommended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Right.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Prevails. The Board of Electricity. Senator Gimsey, were you able to review these people and would like to make that motion? Okay, Senator Gimsey moves that this committee recommend the appointments of these folks on the Board of Electricity to be confirmed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Are you, do you want to visit with us for a little minute? As long as you're sitting there, we're going to take up, because of Speaker Sviggum is sitting there, confirmation of Mr. Sviggum is the Commerce Department of Labor and Industry Commissioner. Most of us, a lot of us have worked.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Sviggum, you're going to. Don't vote him down right
no,
away.
No, not right away. But, I was just wondering how long you get to be the speaker after you've quit the legislature.
Forever. I think you call the speaker, don't you? Today, you're,
I don't know.
You might have to call me president.
Yeah.
Please don't. Please don't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I've been called a few other things that I answer to as well.
That you answer to.
That I answer to, yes.
Senator Day.
Some of it deserved, probably.
Senator Day, I know you're anxious to confirm them, but do you want 2-3 minutes of in-depth discussion or anything or no? I don't need any, but why don't you just give us a couple minutes, Mr. Sviggum, how things have been going in your office. And I know our staff has been getting over there a little bit watching, and you and I visited 3 or 4 times in the last 4 or 5 months, and I'm one that's personally satisfied with the job you're doing so far, but why don't you tell the folks how you think things are going? And I bet they're going good, aren't they? Mr. Sviggum.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Senators, as I look at the Department of Labor and Industry, I'll just do a couple minutes of background,
sure.
Vision, ideas of where we're going, issues we're handling, and try to do it very, very quickly, but to certainly stand for any questions that you might have. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to have kind of a new beginning in public service. I appreciate it a lot and really look forward to serving a great mission with a department I think that is very well run, with a good mission and good performance far before I became commissioner. And as I speak about 3 or 4 or 5 issues that we've tackled in the last 7 months since I've become commissioner, Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that none of the credit probably belongs to me. I have 500-plus very, very good employees at the department who serve Minnesota well and in the best interests of the state and the citizens. And certainly any credit and also then any blame. No, any credit should go to them. Very, very good people. And I found that to be true within the department. Really, really good people who are performance-oriented. Mr. Chairman, when first appointed by the governor to be commissioner last July, I made an effort to outreach to a significant number of stakeholders in the state that have interest in labor and industry issues. We tried very hard with my deputy commissioner, who is back here sitting behind me, Michael Houliston, a really, really decent person, to outreach to every stakeholder that we could find in the state that had interest within the issues dealt with in the department, to go listen to them, hear their expectations, talk about the issues that they may be interested in, fully understanding within this group here as senators, when you make decisions, you can't make everybody happy all the time. If you make a decision, more likely than not, it's sometimes somebody's not going to be happy with that decision, and you are well aware of that being decision makers yourself. Since I've started in the department, let me mention three or four of the issues which have come forward to you and now to the citizens of the state. The first might be following through on the independent contractor rules, a bill passed last year here in the House and Senate, signed by the governor, that allow the department to promulgate rules that have now been drafted, brought to the governor's office, approved by them. Brought forward to the citizens of the state of Minnesota at this point. We're waiting to see how, if we have to continue in a public hearing, if we have 25 persons who would like to be heard and have an interest in the IC rules we're bringing forward. I think if you read the IC rules, which I'm sure some of you on this committee have, as I have done, you will see that the rules are very clear, which we want them to be. We want to be able to go forward in the future and with as black and white as you can be. And I understand that that's always very difficult to determine who is an independent contractor with the exemption per certificate we will be offering them and who is an employee. As you know, the legislative auditor and others have given some question to the department and other departments as to our classification of independent contractors. The rules will not be positive or negative for independent contractor or for employee, but they will be clear in defining whether you are an independent contractor or an employee. And I think that that's what we want in a very just and fair way. There have been some significant concerns, especially within my department, as well as in unemployment, indeed, that we have had numbers of individuals in the past that have worked as independent contractors or been termed independent contractors until something happens on the job site and all of a sudden they're looking for workers' comp coverage or unemployment coverage or not paying the revenues to the state, which may have been forthcoming to the state. So I think the rules will be clear. And if you read the rules, I think you would generally agree that they've been drafted fairly well. Workers' compensation, a bill that's before you being carried by Senator Bach, which you passed out of this committee, I think, a week or 10 days ago. We spent a significant amount of time developing the workers' comp bill through the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. We've included around the state a significant number of stakeholders in developing this bill this year. I'll be fair to you and say that the bill is less than significant. It's less than significant from what I would have wanted to do from a reform bill. But it's a good bill. It moves in the right direction. I think it's a very, very fair bill. Thank you for your support of it. And it provides us an opportunity to have a more significant reform bill probably in the upcoming years. We used operation groups involving stakeholders. We used policy groups involving those stakeholders as well. And then the Workers' Compensation Advisory Committee set up by our statutes was brought forward. I think we had seven maybe different Workers' Compensation Advisory Council meetings with the operations group and the policy groups. I think about 20 meetings in total amongst the stakeholders. And I think we've brought forward a decent bill, a good bill in the right direction. By the way, we will be continuing and furthering that workers' comp reform bill as we bring ownership not only to the stakeholders but to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council itself in the next summer. We have come upon four different committees that we will be meeting starting this month throughout the summer and fall to bring ownership to the issues of the reform items that might be necessary within workers' compensation. By the way, this process has drawn national attention. Just last week, I had interviews from the state of Texas in regards to the operation groups and the work council committees that we've set up in workers' compensation reform. The prevailing wage issue and the minimum wage issue in our labor standards unit, we've tried to bring stakeholders together, some of which are sitting here today, on the issue of minimum wage to see if we can come together cooperatively to address that issue during the legislative session. It was a good meetings amongst good people. I cannot tell you we came to an agreement or a decision yet, but the discussions continue, and hopefully we'll be able to find common ground and come together in the best interest of the state of Minnesota on the issue of minimum wage as well as prevailing wage. Last year, members, you gave us three additional people within the department to do outreach and education on the prevailing wage issue. That has been done. We hired those folks in September, maybe the latter part of September, first part of October. And they have done significant outreach on both the education and the enforcement side on the prevailing wage issue. I think the last thing I'll mention will be our OSHA workers, our OSHA safety, health, safety, and standards department unit, which works very well both from a compliance standpoint as well as a consultation standpoint to help job sites in the state and businesses where people work be safe. Unfortunately, the 10 days after I was appointed commissioner, we had a tragic tragedy of the bridge falling down. You're all well aware of that incident, that tragedy in people's lives. We were out there with OSHA the next day. We're out there 24/7 right now. And we were out there trying to make sure that nobody else got hurt within that bridge site collapse. And the death and the tragedy had already taken place. We wanted to make sure that nobody else in the recovery and in the building would get hurt. And we've developed a partnership out there, as well as a partnership of education of workplace safety around the state, which I think is working very, very well. Our goal is a very, very simple one at the department. That's to make sure that everybody goes home at night the same way they come to work in the morning. While we do realize accidents do take place, we're putting great resources and great effort to make sure that the workplace is safe. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would certainly be open to any comments, questions, as I try to do the role of regulator in a very fair and very, very just way for all citizens of Minnesota.
Well, I just want to say personally that I think there were some people, a lot of people that were quite concerned going in that, you know, there could be a little partisanship here. But I tell you what I've seen, you become a pretty good regulator and administrator of your department. And somebody had to say that, Speaker Swigum, that, you know, there's a lot of concerns out there. But from what I've witnessed, it's been very fair and balanced, your job the last few months you've been there. So.
Thank you. Mr.
Senator Scheidt.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question about the OSHA inspectors. And I think a few years ago, the administration had wanted to cut back on the state OSHA inspections, and I think that we got that settled and we decided not to do that. Do you think we need more inspectors, or you think that it's, you have enough? I don't even know how many you have, so maybe you.
We were given, Mr. Chairman, Representative Scheidt, we were given some additional folks within the consultation part of our OSHA units. Those are the folks that go out and basically work with businesses, work with labor. Right. Educate, make standards that are higher than the normal standards that we inspect upon. We could always use more people. I'm not going to say we couldn't. You know, that would, I assume whenever you have a mission, you can enhance that mission. You can make that mission even better. On the other hand, I think our consultation unit works well and has done a good job in keeping the workplace safe and construction sites safe within the state. The OSHA department, I think what you're referring to is, I believe maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago when we were facing the significant $4.5 billion deficit. I believe there was a recommendation of the governor's office to make Minnesota a federal-run OSHA inspection unit as opposed to state-run. I think the states are pretty well split. About 50-50. Half of them are state-run states. Half of them are federal. Our sister to the east, Wisconsin, is a federal OSHA department where we are state. I think we do a better job, and I think there's a reason that we are a state-run OSHA department. We'd like to see that to continue.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Further quick. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I just want to ask you a couple of questions about a couple of things you said. When you commented that the Senator Bach's workers' comp bill is less than significant, I'm just wondering what you would like to have seen done in the bill that wasn't done.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, there were a number of recommendations which I, as commissioner in the department, had made to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, which we were not able to move forward with at this year just because there wasn't agreement amongst the council. As you understand, you have to have a full buy-in by business, a full buy-in by labor. If there's no agreement, we don't move it forward. That's the process of the advisory council. Let me give you some for instances. A recommendation that I had made, Senator Tomasoni, as you'd be interested in, is rather than the current bill of Representative Box going to $850 as the cap for reimbursement, I had suggested $1,000 as the cap for reimbursement, the two-thirds of your average weekly wage up to a certain cap. And now it's $750. We're going to $850. I had recommended $1,000. I had recommended some more significant reforms within the payment system for our providers within ambulatory surgery centers, hospitals, individuals who provide care within the system. That did not come forward. I tried to recommend that and also tried to make the system more efficient, Senator Tomasoni, by getting costs out of the system for those providers. Providing for prompt pay up front, providing to make sure that when there was a billing at whatever percent of usual and customary charges, that they would get paid that amount. Where right now I'm very, very concerned that you see hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers starting to get 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar of what they actually bill because we have price reducers out there that are reducing that price legally and appropriately. Let's see, we also tried within the workers' compensation system then to rid the system of what is called prevailing charge. Not prevailing wage, Representative Tomasoni, but prevailing charge.
We'll get to that.
There's a difference. We'll get to that. There's a difference. I think what we're seeing is that this usage of prevailing charge within the reimbursement system, although by law to be used, is going to cost the system a significant amount of money in legal fees and time delays, and we're going to end up with a tremendous amount of resources going to not the injured worker, but to someone else involved in the system. In this case, it would be price reducers and attorneys. For instance, Senator Tomasoni, up in your area of the state, actually it was in more in the Duluth area, we have a bill from ambulatory surgery centers.
You know the difference, right?
Between yeah. Excuse me?
You know
I
the
understand
difference.
The difference.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I found out
okay.
that difference about 16 years ago, yes. Okay. I was in Duluth and called it part of the range, and I understand the difference now. I still have the welts on my back. Senator Tomasoni, I forget what prevailing charge. We have a charge from an ambulatory surgery center in the Duluth area, northeastern Minnesota, for about, I think, don't quote me directly to these numbers, but it's about a $80,000 bill. One side has already spent $60,000 in attorney fees. The other side has already spent more than that on an $80,000 bill, and it's being appealed again. So we're going to end up spending $200,000 plus on an $80,000 bill. It seems to be somewhat of a waste of resources in my mind. So I suggested getting rid of prevailing charge. I also suggested, Senator Tomasoni, which you might be interested in too, that within the system, I found it very difficult to look at people who would be on a workers' comp situation for 6 months or a year or 2 years and or further and have them not have health care benefits. So if you will look back to the recommendations I made, I had suggested that health care benefits be covered for the injured worker and his or her family for 2 years at least. Right now they're covered for 3 months by the Family Leave Act. I had also suggested that as we looked at favorably towards a hybrid of an employer choice model for providers. These are all issues that I'm mentioning to you that are going to be studied by and brought information and facts to the committees that I mentioned earlier for this summer. There were a lot of other administrative changes that I suggested, too, but those would be some of the things that you asked about.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, you made another comment about minimum wage. What are you trying to accomplish with minimum wage?
Peace in the Valley.
Which is?
So Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, I don't want to always call you representative.
You're just used to it, that's all. As we get older, it gets worse, too.
And I'm getting older, I guess. Senator, minimum wage. Let me handle it by saying this. For the first time in a significant period of time, the federal minimum wage will be above the state minimum wage. July 24th of this year, it raises to, which is it?
Rises
to $6.55, which is above the state minimum wage, and July 24th of next year, to $09, it rises to $7.25. Which is above the state minimum wage, too. I sense that there is a need, and there will also be a move towards increasing that minimum wage. And I would like to provide a situation of the minimum wage combination training wage, combination raise above tick above the federal minimum wage, service credit, the comma tick. Seeing those eyes are all those things that combine together in that minimum wage issue, that give and take.
Does Rukavina know this?
I've spoken with Mr. Rukavina a few times, yes. In fact, I've spoken with you about it, Mr. Tomasoni. All those things that come together in the making of a good bill that everybody can get together in and have some whether it be peace in the valley or cooperation or whether it be meeting of the minds or common ground, I'm trying to find, in baseball terms, Senator Tomasoni, you would call it the sweet spot. There's a sweet spot there. It's not here and it's not here. But there's a sweet spot that everybody on this committee could get together and vote for. And I'm trying to find that sweet spot.
Some of us think it's pretty sweet already. But anyway, Mr. Chair, one last thing, and this is regards to when you were in front of my committee this year and we were trying to figure out what the budget would be like, and one of your recommendations was to cut out some of the enforcement person that we gave you this year at the Department of Labor and Industry for prevailing wage. We didn't recommend that as coming out of my committee, and now I hear there's an administrative law judge that is claiming unconstitutionality of the prevailing wage enforcement laws, and I'm not sure what an administrative law judge has to do with that, but I know you have to respond to it, and I don't know what you can tell us here today, but first of all, I want to know how you plan to enforce prevailing wage. And then secondly, if you can answer, I would like to know what your response to the administrative law judge is going to be.
Okay, can I just check just for a second?
Sorry.
Okay.
Senator, I had to check with the smart guy. Maybe I need to understand what I can say or not. That's my deputy, by the way. You want to have a deputy that knows everything? And that's good. That's good for me. Senator, to the Comstock case, that's a DOT situation. Comstock, in regards to Administrative Law Judge Lipman, I think, made a decision that basically said the prevailing wage was, I think in his terms, unconstitutionally vague was the term that was used. We felt that our laws at the labor and industry were probably not unconstitutionally vague, so we have asked to the Department of Transportation to give advice to them in this court case. And forgive me if I don't know all the legal terms. I apologize. I'm not a lawyer, as you know. But the department, as of 12 o'clock today, I just read our response to DOT. As of 12 o'clock today, has just sent over our advice and our a concern about the administrative law judge ruling on the unconstitutional vagueness of the prevailing wage, as was ruled in the Comstock case. So we are basically becoming partners with DOT in regards to that, at least from our
defending
advice.
Defending it?
Excuse me?
Defending it?
That mm-hmm. would be correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, that would be correct. And prevailing wage, before your committee, Mr. Tomasoni, Senator Tomasoni, at that time chairman, We were asked in our department to cut 4% by the governor's office. Members, very, very honestly, Department of Labor and Industry gets general fund money only in one area, and that's our labor standards unit. It's the only place we get general fund money. Now, we're either fortunate because of that, because the rest is all either fees, premiums, workers' comp, or federal money, OSHA. The only place we get general fund money is in labor standards unit. That's the only place that I have to reduce 4%. So before your committee, I did suggest that if you are going to reduce this by 4%, if we did have to cut that 4% that the governor recommended, that in our labor standards unit, the place we would probably look at doing it would be reducing from three new persons that you gave us last year to two. The number of persons you gave us to educate, enforce, these are additional folks in the prevailing wage. Now, I realize in your bill that you came forward with that you specifically said no reduction, if I think the words were there.
I just didn't give you a reduction. Rukavina said no reduction.
Oh, was it Rukavina that said no reduction?
I just didn't give you a reduction.
And I respect and understand that. As good, gentle persons, let me just ask you that if you give us a mandate, if you tell us you got to do something, give us the dollars, too. Don't tell us we've got to cut $60,000 and then we've got to keep continuing to do the same program or the same outreach because we can't do it. So tell us what not to do. If you cut us $60,000, $43,000 or $120,000, whatever it may be,
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, this is kind of where the chairman's opinion of the departments comes in, because Senator Metzen has been saying all year that if you have 500 employees, you should be able to find people that can do these jobs within you're within the budget that you have right now without having to worry about cutting people and asking for new money. And so I'm just reiterating what the chairman said. And so I would hope, because we worked really hard last year to try and make sure that we could get some people in place to do some enforcement at Dolly and give you the laws that you needed to get be in place that you wouldn't cut the very people that were hired last year to do the job. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I understand that. I understand that 500 employees, we generally would be able to say that. But remember, we cannot use workers' comp premium for anything but the workers' comp unit. We can't use federal OSHA money for anything other than the health and safety, OSHA enforcement or compliance or consultation. We can't use in our codes, even though we bring in significant monies in the codes, for licenses of plumbers, electricians, high pressure pipe fitters, we can't use those fees for something other than the code enforcement itself. So I'm focusing just to that money that you give us in general fund money. And I'm sure you understand, Senator Tomasoni, that we cannot take federal OSHA money and use it in the labor standards unit. The feds might frown upon that.
Hey, Senator Gerlach first, and then Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that I appreciate Commissioner Swiggum's continued public service. As many of you know, many of us have served with Speaker Swiggum. I know that Senator Latz has, and I know that Senator Tomasoni and Senator Bach and others in the House. And
even Senator Scheid.
And Senator Scheid. And I just wanted to say that I think that the chairman's comments were correct, and that when you said that you saw the what's coming forth is fair and balanced. And I just wanted to say that that is really a hallmark of the commissioner's work, and that is juggling a lot of different interests. And in the end, coming forth and saying, we have to do something, we're going to figure this out, and finding a fair and a balanced way. And I can tell you countless times that Commissioner and Speaker Swiggum had sought that reasonable balance. And there's a lot of competing interests and a lot of different directions and a lot of different tugs. And I just wanted to say that your past track record has been of great service to Minnesota, and that I'm glad that you're continuing your service, because I do know that you put the interests of Minnesota ahead of a lot of other things, a lot of other considerations, and that's important in our commissioners, and that you, as you're enforcing the law. So I appreciate that, and I'm glad we're taking up this confirmation, and I'm sure that we're going to approve this today. And I just want to say thank you for your service.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes. So just a brief question, and perhaps a follow-up, Mr. Chair, to Senator Scheid's earlier question about OSHA. I'm very pleased to hear that you're working with your staff because they are truly experienced and outstanding. So I'm very pleased to hear that, you know, Commissioner. But a question is that in cases where labor standards or OSHA infractions are found, what is your commitment to investigate those, and even more importantly, to follow up to make sure that these changes are permanent? Because in my brief time here at the Senate, it seems that many times we have had, you know, different worker groups coming to us because of, you know, working concerns. Mm-hmm. And so with OSHA, can you perhaps tell us what you'd like to see the department doing to be more, I guess, proactive, reactive to that, and making sure that if infractions are found, that you make sure that the changes are permanent?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, let me try two different things first. First, maybe the OSHA question, and then the question about labor standards and enforcement of that. We're trying to stress and we're trying to encourage and enhance consultation, which is the education, working with people aspect. But we do understand that compliance is an important part of OSHA regulation. You got to have compliance. Wherever you are, you got to have some compliance. You know, if we didn't have compliance in revenue, probably none of us would pay our taxes, you know, if there wasn't some compliance out there or whatever it may be. So we do have compliance, and there we have very, very strict standards that are enforced. I have gone on compliance visits with some of our OSHA inspectors. I have been with the inspector when she looked at the business and said, you're in violation. Workers are at potential risk here, hazards, and we ended up giving them fines. We do fine. We do enforce. We do give violations. In fact, there was a bill that I spoke to some of you when I was in your rooms earlier in relationship to a willful OSHA neglect of repeated violations that we're going to be working on for next year to even bring more teeth to the law. I just wasn't able this year to bring all the parties together to push that bill forward. Labor standards. Let me tell you about just before I came here, 10 minutes, in fact, before I came here, I wrote a gentleman whose daughter had worked for a business in the state who was forced and colleagues of hers for the past years to buy certain personal equipment in relationship to her work, her job. He was into concern. We follow up on complaints. My department, again, not me. I didn't do it. I just get a chance to write the letter back or get the heat or not the heat. Told them that we had recovered for 143 individuals the costs which the individuals had to bear for their personal equipment, in this case some ski equipment, and we recovered those monies for the employees. And I was able to write this individual that for his daughter and for 142 others like her, we were able to recover these monies that by law should not have been charged to them. We take all complaints to labor standards, we take them seriously. I have spoken with my labor standards unit at length, Senator Saltzman, and if there is a complaint that is at least justifiable, we inspect. Now, we make sure it's justifiable, so it's not a call we get at 2 o'clock at night when the bars are closing, and we want to make sure it's not just third party, so it's one business complaining about another business, so we get into the using the department as a weapon. You know, we don't want to do that. We don't want to use the department as a weapon. But individual cases of complaint, we inspect and we enforce and we fine.
Thank you very much. That's just really great to hear because I think that sometimes when we don't enforce the rules that we have, we come back and then try to overreach. So I think having enforcement is just great. So thank you so much for all you're doing in that area, Commissioner. I really appreciate hearing that.
Okay, any further discussions, Senator Carlson?
Mr. Commissioner, I have a couple of questions. One of them is a little shorter answer than the other. I'll ask the short answer first. Is your staff adequate? You mentioned that you would always like to have more staff. Of course, everyone likes to have more staff. But is your staff adequate presently? And do you have any open positions that are unfilled? And is a hiring freeze a problem for you? And will you be able to carry out your responsibilities with your present staff?
Commissioners Swigum.
Yes, no, no, yes.
Good.
Okay, next question. I don't remember myself. Maybe I better clarify, Senator Carlson. You tried to ask about four questions there, and I was trying to keep track. But you can always use more staff, and you can always do more compliance. You can always do more consultation. Without question, we could do more. But within the balance of the cost benefit, the dollars that are there, we have great staff who do a super, super job. And if you could see, Mr. Carlson, if you could see our folks that work in the compliance or the consultation unit of OSHA, I think you would be extremely impressed. It may be the best unit in all of state government. Those folks are really, really, really good. Could you use another person or two? We just do more consultation if we had that. But if we don't have it, then, I recognize that, and, we work within what we do have. We do have a hiring freeze, as you know, upon us right now. We do have some positions that are open. If it's a safety-sensitive position, the deputy commissioner will try to get an exemption from DOOR. Other than that, we will we're under a hiring freeze, plain and simple. And I don't think that there are any necessarily safety-sensitive positions right now, although we do have openings for sure. And then last question. Oh, you didn't get this next question yet.
Mr. Carlson?
Yes. I guess just to follow up on that one, how many openings are unfilled? And what's the nature of
it? Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, let me look back. Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, three positions due to the hiring freeze.
And
Senator Carlson?
Just minor clarification, if those are on-the-ground types of people, inspectors or administrative. But then we'll get into the next question, and that is that how do you plan on running your department differently than any of your predecessors? And do you have any types of, let's say, best practices that you intend to initiate or any innovations that can make your department more efficient?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I think my predecessors as commissioners were all super folks, and I'm not sure that I can meet the quality of the standard that was set there. I will try. At least in 7 months, I haven't closed the place up yet. I'm always concerned that it's close it up, but it's working so far. But I have shoes to fill, which are good. I will probably... There's different styles. Different people have different styles. Different senators have different styles. I try to include people. I try to outreach. I try to bring ownership. I try to bring some common ground cooperation amongst folks by bringing them together. Does it always work? No. We understand it doesn't always work, and then you get to make a decision. It's my hope that on most of the issues that come before you, that I will have tried to work out significant differences, Senator, before they get to you to be having to make a difficult decision. That's why this year in our agenda, members, if you remember when I did come and visit you in your office, I mentioned two bills that we have not brought forward this year, and that's because we have not been able to I don't think they're ready for prime time. Because I haven't been able to bring together the outside groups yet to say this is reasonable, this is common sense. So I've tried to bring forward to you an agenda that is already worked out in the process, or at least worked out enough so that there is a cooperation, a common ground, and not just bringing forward something that's significantly controversial and putting yourselves in very, very difficult positions. I would think that within the department itself, working with the unit supervisors, they might tell you that I might be a little bit more aggressive pushing for performance, looking at performance indicators, whether it be in dispute resolution or workers' compensation. or whether it be in the number of visits that our OSHA compliance folks do. I think if you were asked the persons that I get to work with today, they would probably tell you I'm a little bit more asking for accountability from performance standards.
And Carlson,
one last one. And do you see your role as primarily regulator, enforcer, or advisor? And which one do you think you maybe do the best, and which one should be the focus, do you think? Do you think we should be upfront more than perhaps we have been as an advisor so that we can avoid problems in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, first of all, I think maybe as I've stressed the OSHA consultation part of the presentation today, I think you would say that I try to promote education and promote upfront working together as opposed to just the compliance and enforcement on the back end. I think that we have done that in the last 7 months. My role, Senator Carlson, probably has changed somewhat. The hat that I wore as an advocate, and certainly I was an advocate for many groups and many issues without question, you know, as you are. My hat has changed from that of an advocate to that of a regulator in a fair and just way for, you know, all citizens, best interests of the state, on a application of the law and regulating the intent of the law you pass. That doesn't mean everybody's always going to agree with the decision that gets made, but, you know, I'll try to follow that law very, very closely and directly, and I think there are those in this room here that would probably say that maybe being aware of being a regulator is the good balance that I need to always understand that my hat has changed, and if I'm aware of that, I'm probably aware of the balance in the regulator decision as opposed to the advocacy position.
Okay.
Thank you.
A pretty, our 10-minute discussion got into 40 or 50, but
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion?
Yeah, pretty quick. Senator Day had his hand up, I think, earlier and wanted to make that motion.
I would love to move that Steve Swigum be confirmed the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Industry. And I guess I would tell everybody, and I've known Steve 20-some years. Was a seatmate of his for about 12 years, and of course I, as a minority leader, dealt with him, and I think what anybody would know about him is that he's just a decent individual. He gets along with people really well, and it's whether it's Democrats or Republicans, he's got an absolutely wonderful family due to the fact that his wife probably had a lot to do with that, Deb, probably. I think that's why they all excelled, was because they had a wonderful, he has a wonderful wife also, but Steve goes way back as a teacher and a coach, and he's just a good, decent guy, and as far as how well he's doing as a job, I don't know, but I know that he will do well because he's just that type guy. He is always, he's given his life to public service. And that's rare. And then when you're in leadership, as you well know, you get a few warts along the line. But it's very interesting that when you have these little battles and you get a few warts as you move through life, you see the people that you've had little battles with that will say, hey, Steve's really doing a good job. And so I give you credit for that and like to move his confirmation.
Very good. Any further remarks? If not, Senator Day renews his motion that this committee recommends the confirmation of Mr. Swigum as Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. All those in agreement signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Senators.
Okay, maybe this Thomas L. Johnson Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Are you here? I don't know, is Mr.
Insert Julian Close.
Does anybody know him or anything? Or? Anybody, Mr. Johnson was supposed to have been here. Did anybody in the committee know him personally, or do we like him? We not like him. I think we, well, we have more time. When do we get back together?
Guy stands up.
That, sit down. Who are you? Are you Mr. Johnson?
Thomas Johnson, yes.
Oh, sit down for a second. We just want to say hello to you. And, I think you're lucky because Speaker Swigum took up all your time. So, but we'd still like to hear in briefly kind of what your job is and if you like it, and tell us as you're doing a good job so we can confirm you. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm Tom Johnson. I'm the Chief Judge of the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Very briefly, what we do is we're the intermediate court handling workers' compensation cases. The trial court is what's called the Office of Administrative Hearings. That's where the case is tried. If someone is displeased with the result, then they're entitled to an appeal. That first appeal comes to us. That's an appeal on the record. That is, a transcript is prepared of the testimony, and then there are exhibits. And then our court reviews it. We work in panels of three. We have to issue a decision. We're statutorily obligated to issue a decision within 90 days of the date we have oral argument. And then if anyone is unhappy with our decision, the final appeal is to the Supreme Court. That is an automatic appeal because, as you know, we are an administrative agency, and the Supreme Court will be the first judicial review of the decision of the workers' compensation judge.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
I would like to believe that we are doing a good job. The workers' compensation bar is quite small, just a few hundred lawyers who have been doing it for many years. We all know each other. So probably 75% of the lawyers who do work comp I know on a first-name basis. And we get together and we talk. I think I have a pretty good pulse on how the lawyers feel about our court and our system. And generally, I think both sides are very happy. Both the plaintiff's lawyers and the defense lawyers feel that they get a fair hearing in front of our court. If you have to make a decision, somebody wins and somebody loses, so somebody's always unhappy. I think, by and large, people are pleased with what we do. Feedback I get from the Supreme Court is they feel we're doing a good job, and they're happy because our appeals to them go down.
Judge Johnson, Tomasoni wants to speak up because you were a youth hockey coach. Huh? Good for you. And baseball and soccer, so you gave time back to the kids, too, which is always, I always like to see that, the people that. Other than that, Senator Tomasoni.
I just wanted to ask him a question. Is there any particular type of appeal that you see more than others? I mean, I guess I don't exactly know what that question even really means when it comes to worker comp appeals. But, I mean, is it back injuries? Is it just the settlement? I mean, what type of appeals do you actually get in the?
Johnson.
Well, Senator, Mr. Chairman, it really runs the gamut from the question of whether or not somebody's been injured, whether the injury actually happened, to the extent of the benefits to which someone might be entitled, whether someone is an independent contractor, or the case that Commissioner Swigum just talked about at the Ambulatory Surgery Center in Duluth about the prevailing charge. So it is quite a large, within the field of workers' compensation, they can vary quite a bit, the cases.
You have that little red light and green light on, and a little yellow light for the people that are testifying so they know exactly how long they have?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, yes, we do.
You do, okay.
Okay, any other questions of Judge Johnson? Would he like to... Senator Tomasoni moves that this committee recommend the confirmation of Thomas L. Johnson to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Senators.
We've got a DIBL bill up that this is for Just discussion and informational purposes. It has to do with the Railroad Walkway Safety Act, and I'd like to we have to be out of here in about 25 minutes, so we hate to rush people, but that's the way it's going to be. So we'll hear about 10 or 12 minutes probably from each side on the Railroad Walkway Safety Act, and there will be no votes taken, but we do want to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have Senate File 3572, which is a bill that has to do with the construction and maintenance of the area next to railroad tracks where workers have to walk and perform their duties on a regular basis. And I think the reason we're hearing this is because this bill was referred from the Transportation Committee. And I know that Senator Murphy wants to be sure that everything gets its full airing and vetting in the appropriate policy committees. It is coming through on the House side and in the House omnibus bill. Not that we discuss what's going on in the other chamber, but we want to be sure that folks who are on this committee have a chance to know what's going on if anything were to emerge and pass into policy. Yet this year it's important for this committee to be aware of it and make their views known. Very quickly, Mr. Chair, this is an issue that's been in front of the legislature for a couple years now, at least. We had a proposal last year that was quite a bit more expansive than what you see in front of you today. And it has to do with the issue of worker safety, railroad workers who are walking alongside tracks, doing their duties, like I said earlier, to be sure they have kind of walk space that's clean, free of debris, constructed in the proper manner, drains well. Right now, state statute is pretty silent on this specific subject, and it is a function of state statute to have to deal with this specific kind of issue. I do know that very possibly we'll have we don't currently have any in-state on-site railroad inspectors. We'll have that very soon, and this will create some standards to which they can inspect this particular piece. If it's your pleasure, Mr. Chair, I'll just run through very quickly the provisions of the bill. The first part of the bill, Section 1, deals with the standards to which these walkways need to be constructed, the materials, the drainage, some of the particulars around the geometrics of what these walkways need to look like. Section 2 simply deals with grandfathering existing track and making sure also that we're confining the track to those spots where workers work frequently or switch yards and the like. The bill, this is a contrast to the bill last year, which was kind of everything everywhere, which was very onerous, burdensome, expensive, not well advised. So this is a significant scale back. Section 3 deals with some specifications for some other spots, also some exceptions to the grandfathering provision. When there's a particularly bad situation, the commissioner or the inspector can order some work to be done. Section 4, some exceptions to compliance during specific times when maintenance activities are going on, heavy rain, snow, washouts, derailments, etc. Section 5 provides for a process for a waiver that leaves the discretion to the commissioner. Section 6, just make sure that before violations are enforced that that the problem is identified, brought to the attention of the railroad, and in fact there's an attempt to remedy the problem before a violation is filed and enforced. Correct. Oh, it looked like you had a question. Section 7 says that for that track that is captured by this bill, that the work be done only when there's an opportunity to do it, when there's major construction going on in that particular area. Paragraph B of that same section exempts the smaller carriers in our state. This has to do with the large carriers only, except I think when there's a particular specific situation that the commissioner identifies as a particular problem. Mr. Chair, with that, I have Phil Qualley here from the United Transportation Union, and he can share some thoughts as well.
Hey, Mr. Qualley, welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you very much for hearing this bill this afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Philip Qualley. I'm State Legislative Director for the United Transportation Union. I will have a couple of testifiers who will speak briefly. Mr. Joel Anderson from UTU Local 1067, the Canadian National property, as well as Mr. Randy Raskin, UTU Local 650 from the Union Pacific property. And I'd also like to thank Senator Dibble for sponsoring this bill. We think that it's been a long road to find something that is close to a compromise with the carriers. We've done everything that we can. We think that this is a well-balanced bill. And we're particularly proud that the bill will make sure that on-property processes are held in place to try to fix issues that we have, safety issues, in-house before we should apply to MnDOT for assistance. And I would like to speak to the need very briefly for the bill. Having said that, we have provided a handout for you that has a ergonomic study as well as a Blue Flyer handout that has injury statistics from the Federal Railroad Administration exclusive to the state of Minnesota, as well as photographs of some of the kind of conditions that we're trying to improve. We have also included in the blue handout safety committee unresolved issues page from the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, which will show many areas of walking surfaces that simply have not been approved that have been and reported prior. Finally, we also have attached a piece of the Canadian National, which safety committee minutes, which Mr. Anderson can speak to a little bit later. But, Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, we had 27 slip, trip, and fall injuries in the state of Minnesota last year in 2007. If we look at the first page, we've highlighted the specific type of falls that have occurred. And we've excluded slip, trip, and fall injuries where there were weather conditions involved. And if you take a look at these breakdowns, you'll see there are all sorts of types of injuries. But very clearly, we've highlighted those that are by track side and beside track. And these are not happening in carpeted rooms or anything like that. These are out on the right-of-ways and in the yards of Minnesota. We'd also like to point out there is a trend between 2005, year 2006, and year 2007, we do see injuries increasing. We believe that this legislation is necessary and that, in fact, if we can eliminate slip, trip, and fall injuries, we will save the carriers a great deal of money. I would like to speak just briefly. While the FRA injury statistics speak about actual traumatic injuries, we also are concerned about cumulative trauma injuries, where workers that are working over the course of their careers are walking on larger right-of-way mainline ballast, and that this is taking a real toll on their bodies. We'd like to point out that when we can look at injury statistics as a potential for a need for this legislation. When we talk about injuries, I want to remind you that there are hundreds of falls out on the railroad where workers get right back up and keep right on going. There's no statistic for that, but we're simply trying to provide a standard that will improve railroad safety. A couple of quick pieces that I would like to touch on as well. We now have railroad workers that are operating remote-controlled locomotives. So not only are they out working in the yards on the main lines, with a lantern and radio in hand or on their body, with a switch list, getting on and off the equipment, in between the equipment, on and about, and throwing switches, or actually have a belt pack on where they're operating a locomotive. We're simply saying that where there's high traffic frequency, they should have the smaller ballast subject to drainage and assure that they have good walkways. We see more crews working in interchange on different railroads. In other words, Railroad A will send employee A over to Railroad B or Railroad C and be working on different properties, interchanging all throughout the state. We think that setting a standard for limited, concise areas of the main line around switch stands is a reasonable safety assurance piece that can cut down on injuries. And then finally, the most important thing in the railroad business for safety is not only are people not getting hurt, but is about maintaining track integrity, track structure for proper drainage. And we've brought today a two trays of ballast. And on your right is what we call right-of-way mainline 4-inch rock ballast. This assures that the voids in between the spaces of the rock will hold a track structure firm and avoid derailment and will allow the moisture to drain from the ballast and the main line appropriately. In no way does this bill intend to any way inhibit drainage of the main line track and track structure itself. The smaller ballast on your left is what we call Class 5. This ballast is what's used in 95% of the yards now in the state of Minnesota. This does allow for drainage. We're simply saying that this should become a standard for key, concise, limited segments out along beside the track by mainline switch stands and so on and so forth. By way of cost, you should also please keep in mind that you can buy this retail for approximately $18 a yard. This is a higher cost. The key here being that the railroads are in an integral part of the business is having ballast. Two of the railroads in this state own their own quarries. We really don't think that this is an additional cost. We're looking at maybe 1 or 2 yards of this being spilled out near switch stands and walkways for key areas to smooth out the ground and avoid injuries. Finally, when I speak of drainage, the question of federal preemption always must visit a state law and the creation of a state law. The issue with federal preemption in this matter is moot. We do not feel that this law would be federally preempted. We have crafted this law this year, or excuse me, this bill this year, from what is formerly the Illinois state walkway law. 7 other states in the country have walkway laws. But we're pleased to report that on December 17, 2007, the the Federal District Court of Northern Illinois ruled in Norfolk Southern Railway versus essentially the state of Illinois that the walkway laws are not preempted. So at that, I will just ask a couple of, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
We only have couple more minutes on your side and 10 minutes on the other side.
I'd like to bring forward Mr. Joel Anderson, if I may, off the Canadian National. Thank you very much, committee members.
Yeah,
I think this
you're
is
welcome.
A fair and balanced bill. Thank you.
You don't have time to read all that.
No.
Oh, okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Senators. Thanks for hearing my testimony today. I'm Joel Anderson. I'm the legislative rep for Local 1067 on the former DWP, now the CN. And we also represent the Mesabi DMIR Railroad. I have 11 years on the railroad and work as a conductor and a locomotive engineer. And I'm also the chairman of the On-Property Safety Committee. CN took us over in 2003, and since then, our safety has gone downhill consistently. This legislation is needed. I respectfully ask you to refer to the blue handout that you were handed, and then towards the back, our safety minutes are in here. And right now we have 45 unfinished safety items, many of them with walking conditions. I want to point out the carrier has removed a lot of the dates. We used to have the dates so that we could get the oldest done first, and they've removed a lot of those. On our railroad, we also have a rule the company enforces on watching roll-bys, and our trains go 60 miles an hour, and we're not even furnished a reasonable place to watch them from. There's bands that go over large cars of wood, and it's very dangerous, and I would recommend any of you see how close you can get to a moving train. It's pretty scary. In closing, I'd like to tell a story. I just worked with the conductor. He's 35 years old, physically fit, and he's already complaining about ankle and knee pain. He's only been on the railroad 11 years, and we all have to work till we're 60 years old before we can retire. And in short, that's what I have for you. I would thank you for hearing my testimony. I would answer any questions you may have for me.
Okay, did you have another witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, I'd like to request local chairman Randy Raskin from UTU Local 650 off the Union Pacific property, who was up all night bringing a train in, who's come here to testify today. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, senators, thank you very much. I'll be very brief, very short. I believe this is a very good bill. This would greatly improve the working conditions that railroaders work under. I'll just share a short story with you in regards to an employee. We had a new hire who was under probation during his time as training. His name is Mr. Dennis Dean, and while he was in training, crew was making a change out where one crew takes over for another crew, and it was in a recently newly constructed area, and it was made in an area with this larger type ballast. Mr. Dean slipped, and because of the slip, he broke his arm, and shortly before his probation was up, he was let go. We believe it was a direct correlation with the fact that he was injured, and it could have easily, we believe, been prevented because of the type of walking conditions there. I don't want to take up too much time. I just appreciate you listening to us and having us here. I've been on the railroad for 11 years, it seems as if the process of safety that the carrier uses just seems to kind of go downhill throughout those 11 years. So I'd encourage you to support this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of the – all right, we're going to hear from the other side for
– Mr. Chairman, real quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Somebody, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, real quickly, for those of us who have train tracks in their district,
yes,
and you ran around them when you were a kid and running up and down them, it's way easier to run on that Class 5 stuff than it is on that other stuff over there, just so you know. And
yeah.
I know that walking on railroad tracks is difficult.
Did you, Senator, put the pennies down there on the rail and flatten them out?
My dad told me he did that, but I never tried that. My dad used to do it.
Gerlach, did you ever do that?
Hibbit.
All the time.
Flattened them out.
Senator Rosen, did you do that? No.
Yeah.
That would explain the derailment.
That's a derailment.
Set up a whole road. Mr. Sir, we don't want to talk about that.
We'd collect taconite pellets for slingshot ammo.
Senator Rosen, did you have
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Qualley or Senator Dibble, do we have a price tag on something like this? How much
has that been discussed to anybody? I guess the question is a price tag on...
there's no public price tag, but it would definitely cost the carriers something. Certainly not as much as my first bill, which would have cost a lot. I don't know specifically, but Mr. Qualley talked a little bit about the relative expense between the two. And again, existing track is grandfathered. Small carriers are exempt. We're only asking them to do this when there's an opportunity, when they're already reconstructing or doing major renovation of a particular section. The cost can be rolled into some of that earlier work and is minimal. And the railroad is going to be up in a moment. They can probably answer that question more precisely. That hasn't been the concern that's been articulated to me. It's more of a need issue or a precedent issue that's been articulated as the larger concern.
I think you've got I don't think you hit on it enough, but there are a number of exemptions in this bill, too.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
And waivers and exemptions. And then when you do this kind of work on the walkways, it's in conjunction with other work they'll be doing at the time. So it's not like you're bringing in a whole new crew because you've got the workers there anyway.
Exactly.
And buses, waivers, and the small carriers.
This is confined to high traffic,
foot
traffic areas.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to hear from the other folks.
Thank you very much.
I'm afraid we have to. I'm not afraid that we have to hear from the other folks. But we're going to hear from the other folks.
Nothing to be feared. Healthy debate.
It's the big bad railroads, I guess.
All right, we've got about 7-8 minutes. If you guys could be
half an hour.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Appitz. I'm with the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. This is Brian Sweeney. He's going to go first, but we're going to try to actually be quite short because there is a third party, and that's the department that would be responsible for enforcing this, and I think you should hear from them as well before we close out your session this afternoon. So we'll try to be quick.
I'll be as brief as I can with this. My name is Brian Sweeney. I'm legislative counsel for BNSF Railway in St. Paul. Here to speak in opposition to this bill, which, as you can see from the handout that's making its way around, is, we believe, a solution in search of a problem. If you look at the trend in slip, trip, and fall injuries among railroaders, injuries in general, all the trends have been in the right direction in the last 10 years. The number of total injuries suffered by railroad workers in the state of Minnesota has gone down by half or more in the last 10 years. The number of injuries attributed to falls has also fallen by more than half. Those attributed to falls on the ballast surface, the area, the ballast, the rock around the track, the area that this bill would actually address, those also have dropped by more than 50% over this period of time. So when you look at the, you know, the last 5 years, the average of these injuries on the ballast that would be affected by this bill, about 9 a year. The preceding 5 years, it was 20 or more per year. So all the trends are going in the right direction. That's why, as I said, the problem is being addressed. We just don't see the need for special legislation addressing this. We also have in place an existing state statute dealing with a reasonable standard for a safe walkway or work area between tracks. MnDOT has the authority to enforce that. To our knowledge, it has not been used in recent years in anybody's memory for this type of a situation. Where it has been used in the last year has been for areas that would not be covered by this proposed statute. So we see it what we oppose is that primarily the notion that we're going to have a regulation put upon us for no apparent reason. If you look at the chart that I handed out, you'll see that compared with other industries in Minnesota, our record looks, you know, very comparable. It's not like things are out of whack in the railroad industry compared to the rest of the state. 2006, there were 4,300 injuries. This isn't a true apples-to-apples comparison. The number for Minnesota is workers' comp, 3 days or more lost work. Railroads aren't under state worker comp program. We're under a federal program. So the comparison would be with the injuries that were reported to the Federal Railroad Administration. So you can see that our trend has been favorable and that we don't seem to have anything disproportionate with the rest of the state. A question was raised about the cost. Very quickly, it's impossible to say. We would have to do an inventory of all of our yard tracks among all the railroads to see what would qualify under the proposed regulation and what would have to be redone. If we have to do a new one starting with grading, it can cost as much as $75,000 a mile. There would be a number of locations where, yes, it would be much more economical than that. It's not free, however. There would be cost attached. Again, impossible to say without first doing a full tilt evaluation of all of our locations. I'm concerned that the bill, it started off with Illinois combined with some stuff from Nevada and kind of put together, and then it was refined and then cut and so on. I've got some concerns still with the way that it's worded. While it is substantially better than it was a year ago, I'm still not clear about how to infer some of the provisions because of the way it was pieced together. For example, there isn't a clearly stated directive of putting in walkways at switch stands on main line and secondary main. I believe that's the intent. It's not stated, but it could be inferred two different ways, as we have to have walkways along these tracks, and then at the switch stands you have this other type of configuration. I don't think that's what was intended. It could also be inferred, I think, as only in those locations where the commissioner directs you to do something, it would be to the standard. So we have clarification problems, even if something were to be done, that would have to be addressed before this thing would really be in very good shape. With that, I'll quickly pass the ball off to Mr. Appitz and take any questions that you might have.
move to the sidetrack. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, which consists of the short lines and regional railroads that operate in the state of Minnesota, and a couple of Class 1s or the larger railroads as well. And I will be brief as well. I want to be real clear about this. The railroads in the state of Minnesota do not support this bill. There has been talk at one point or another as we've gone through this process that because they did in Illinois, they should in Minnesota. The railroads in Minnesota do not support this legislation. And that's in part because we don't know why this legislation is being brought forward in the first place. Do we really need this bill? Is the question that you all have to ask yourselves. And let me just run through a little bit of data and a little bit of evidence, and maybe we can answer the question that way. Railroads are real serious about safety. I mean, it is a fact that trains and people do not mix very well. And that being the case, railroads do everything they can to try to create a safe and sound work environment. What do we do? Where we have issues of safety and safety along the workforce or along in the workplace, we have daily briefings that we go through. We have dispatcher alerts that can be used for conversations with the dispatcher to alert the operators to problems that might arise. You've got a track defects book. You just saw it. It was laid out. It was the information that you just were looking at in that blue sheet. We've got a track safety hotline. And there are safety committees at each railroad where management and labor get together. One of the things that we've been kind of chagrined about is that in Iowa and Wisconsin, where we have these safety committees, the folks who just came up here and talked to you participate in those safety committees. In Minnesota, for some reason, they do not. The indication has been that they don't think they're effective, but apparently they are in other states. We've got some government programs that deal with these issues as well. The Federal Railroad Administration has standards and inspectors that inspect track and inspect walkways. And if I can be very brief, so does the state of Minnesota. There's already procedures in place. Do we need another set of bills and another set of law standards? I don't think so. And I just handed you a little chart here that would indicate the safety record that railroads try to achieve. One of the things that I think is fascinating is the fact that of all the sort of major industries that have issues with safety, railroads are one of the safest. And amongst the transportation modes that we compete with, railroads, again, are the safest. So in sum, the railroads don't support this bill, and I think the evidence is behind us as to why we don't need the legislature setting standard for the size of rock that goes along railroad tracks in the state of Minnesota. We'd ask you not to approve this bill, and we think the evidence demonstrates that we really don't need to.
Okay, any questions of the witnesses? Okay, we're, like I mentioned earlier, this is just a hearing. I think the Transportation Committee wanted us to look at it first, and we're not going to make any recommendations today, and if it goes to the Transportation Committee, so be it, but we wanted to get it out in the open and have some testimony. So with that, any closing thoughts? Or with that, committee stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.